I'm Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us as we now switch gears to talk about the auto industry's big gamble, battery-powered cars. Glenn Bauer is an automotive faculty advisor and a senior scientist in mechanical engineering in the UW College of Engineering. And Glenn, real pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Jim.
Congratulations. You're going to be a father again, I understand.
That's correct.
Coming up in maybe less than 24 hours.
Possibly.
Good luck to you. More than 20 electric models of vehicles will arrive at dealerships over the next 3 years, led by the Nissan Leaf and the Chevrolet Volt. I understand you got the chance to drive the Volt this weekend.
That's correct. I had one of my alumni that works for General Motors Hybrid Division brought one over, and I actually got to drive it. So it is, just sitting in the car is like basically entering the cockpit of an aircraft. There's so many things that they're calculating, and I looked at their blog, and they're saying they have more lines of code to control the car than, you know, like 10 or 20 times what they normally have in a normal car, because mm-hmm. they're just so sophisticated, and they're trying to display a lot of that to you. And so because of that, there are just so many gauges and things to look at that the first time you drive this, it should probably be in a parking lot so you don't have an accident.
If you'd like to join the conversation about electric vehicles, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email address talk@wpr.org. The Volt is not an inexpensive vehicle.
No, it's not. And so there's the Leaf and the Volt are distinctively different. The Leaf is an all pure electric. So basically, the energy you can store in the battery is what you get for what we call vehicle range before you have to recharge mm-hmm. or refuel. The Volt is what we call an EREV, and that's a new acronym for everybody, but it's called an electric range extended vehicle. And so you can, in the Volt, do about 40, 45 miles on all electric. And so if you're a more aggressive driver, you'll get less than that. And if you're, there's some display in the Volt to help you kind of drive to maximize your battery mm-hmm. life also, or the range you go with that. But after that, then there's actually an internal combustion engine on board, and it basically turns on. And in the city, it works as a generator, and you still use the electric motor as a drive. And then if you get to like a highway speed, it has the capability of locking the two sides together. And at that point, you're using enough power that you just use the power directly from the engine itself. And so they can do about 400 miles total before having to refueling. And here again, if you're just commuting on a normal basis, 40 miles electric range. So the market is to the commuting market, you commute less than 40 miles a day. You can use it for that all EV. You want to go see your brother, your mom, your dad for the weekend. They live 200 miles away. You just jump in the car and you go. You don't have to stop halfway at a diner and try to find a plug-in to charge your electric vehicle. And so that's the difference between the two vehicles.
Glenn Bauer is our guest. He's an automotive faculty advisor and senior scientist in mechanical engineering at the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Critics of electric cars say that they are too expensive, they take too long to recharge, they don't provide enough driving range before they run out of juice. The Leaf will take 8 hours to charge with a 240-volt charger that will cost the driver $2,200 to install, and when fully charged will drive about 100 miles. That seems like the trade-off is not that great.
You must be getting the same websites I am, because that was the facts I read right before I came over. But that is the downside of this, is that we're storing the energy in a chemical bond like fuel, we're storing it as an electron on a plate of metal, and that's a battery. And so we have to, it's sort of like a pipeline or a hose. You can only put electrons into the battery so fast. And if you try to put them in too fast, it becomes very inefficient and you create lots of heat, and which is unsafe.
Mm-hmm. And so it takes 8 hours to fully charge.
Yes. So we're still bound by physics. Much like we're held to the ground by gravity, there's only certain things we can do to make these charges go faster.
Let's go to the phones, take some calls. We'll start with Steele in Appleton. Hello, Steele.
Yes. Hey, gentlemen. Yeah, your first comment just blew me away. Getting into the Volt just like a cockpit of an aircraft. And I have a multi-engine rating aircraft. And when I first learned to fly, I got terrified of driving on two-lane highways. And God help us all, for the people that are driving the Volt, well, for the people that will get hit when they're texting, too. That's what? My comment.
Okay, the texting was a separate comment.
Oh, no. When they have all the gauges and texting, God help us all.
I see.
Yeah, well, General Motors can only do so much. I mean, I believe texting is illegal to do while driving in most states. And, they, as the automobile manufacturer, obviously can't control that. They do limit, if you're sitting still, you get to see about 7 or 8 times as much information as you're allowed to see when it is in drive. And so they do limit a lot of the information you can get to while driving, and that is a safety precaution. And so what it's basically doing is the vehicle itself has somewhat a help screen for a computer software that mm-hmm. if you're wondering why you didn't get enough range, you can go in there and it'll tell you, okay, this maybe occurred or this occurred, those type of things. So they're trying to make it so that they don't have to call a service line to get help answering a question. And so the only thing that really you can see on the heads-up display while this thing is driving is that they do have an integrated navigation system. But there are still a lot of buttons to control all of the radio, the HVAC, all those different things in the vehicle.
One of the questions I have is whether manufacturers have decided to include some kind of sound effect of their vehicle for people who have audio hearing difficulties.
Yeah, and so and this is interesting you brought this up. So he actually showed me what they did in the Volt. And what you do is when you flip your high beams on the left would be turn indicator. On the Volt, if you pull that towards you, it does a chirping noise. And so what they decided was through some consumer surveys is that just activating the horn basically enraged people more often, So what they did is they created a secondary sound of like a chirp chirp.
Which is heard at various traffic signals, probably close to that.
Yeah, and so I think they picked something that that the deaf already have as a signal of precaution, maybe at when they do mm-hmm. the crosswalks and stuff. And so it's maybe half the volume of the normal horn, but there again, you as the driver have to activate it. I mean, I suppose in the future we have these competitions where we do unmanned vehicles driving through the city. I'm guessing sooner somebody's going to put a camera in the front of here, and if there's somebody in the crosswalk, they'll automatically turn that chirp on.
All right. We're talking with Glenn Bauer, automotive faculty advisor, senior scientist in mechanical engineering at the UW-Madison College of Engineering. And if you would like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-642-1234, and we have lines open for you. Did have an email from John in Milwaukee. Will we soon have more small diesel cars in the United States like they do in Europe?
Well, what's happening is that the diesels are becoming cleaner, and they're approaching the level at which the tailpipe emissions would meet the standard set forth in the United States. And so that is one option to increase fuel economy. Here again, a diesel engine with the appropriate exhaust after treatment is going to be a significant premium to mm-hmm. a normal car. So if you do this for a truck, if you go buy a truck, usually the diesel package is $2,500 to $3,000, or about 8 to 10% of the cost of the vehicle as an add-on. And so that is one option to the country. And there's some research patented here at the university that we probably be incorporating in our next vehicle competition, and that's they're actually operating what we call homogeneous charge combustion ignition, and you blend two fuels, ethanol and diesel fuel, as the two fuels, and they're actually able to meet tailpipe emissions without any after treatment and about 40 to 50% more efficient than the normal diesel engine. Now, this is at one speed at one load. So before everybody jumps the boat here, I mean, this is just initial stages, and it's been repeated in multiple locations. So the first type of application for this is like a series vehicle where you run one generator speed and basically one load.
Let's take a phone call, and we'll get this from Bill in Eau Claire. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Hey, I was curious on the repair bills on the electric car and the Volt compared to the internal combustion engine. Would it be substantially more? I mean, general repairs, taking your vehicle in for general maintenance. I wonder if you gentlemen have a word on that.
Unfortunately, I think to start with, the repair bills would probably be more expensive. The driving factor there is just going to be the number of units produced because, I mean, they're talking about 10,000 of the Chevy Volts versus the normal production probably runs, at least 100,000, maybe 200,000 in a year. You're just producing so many more whatever it is, turn signals, turn lamps, batteries, engines, that the overall price comes way down with that mass production. So hopefully the automotive companies will be not trying to make profits on these parts like they normally do. Yeah, so I'm guessing they're going to try to control the cost of that. That does bring up an interesting issue, though, is that the automotive companies now have to retrain all the mechanics in the United States.
And let's pick up on that point when we come back after checking the latest news from NPR. I'm Jim Packard. We're talking with Glenn Bauer, who is a senior scientist in mechanical engineering at the UW College of Engineering, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about battery-powered cars with Glenn Bauer, is an automotive faculty advisor and senior scientist in mechanical engineering in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Glenn, real pleasure to have you with us and your expertise today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jim.
More than 20 electric models of vehicles will arrive at dealerships over the next 3 years. They're led by the Nissan Leaf and the Chevrolet Volt. And the chief executive of Nissan Motor Company, Carlos Ghosn, foresees all electric models making up 10% of all vehicles sold by the year 2020. Nissan plans to sell 200,000 of its Leaf electric model in the United States by the end of 2013. Lots of skeptics cautioning that all electric boosters are too optimistic. What's your take on this?
Well, I mean, I've got a couple comments I've been thinking about. With recent memoirs coming out with President Bush and the whole Hurricane Katrina, and I was thinking now, how long did it take them to get electricity restored? And if you had an electric vehicle, you can't,
charge the battery if you don't have the power.
Yeah, and they have trouble getting fuel in at the same time, but obviously you could use generators to charge your cars, but that's not something we would normally think of. Normally we just take, 5-gallon cans of gasoline to an area of a catastrophe like that and refuel the cars. So that was one thing I thought of. The other thing that's with the Leaf right now, and I talked to some people yesterday that work with heating elements, and their claim was that currently the Leaf doesn't have a system for warming the battery. So if you live in a very cold climate, the Leaf isn't something you should have. If the batteries get too cold, the electrons can't flow through the lithium. It's like a paste, we'll say. Mm-hmm. Think of it as honey. So take the honey and put it in your refrigerator, and how thick does it get? It doesn't flow very well. And so what happens is you basically overcharge one end of the battery while the other end of the battery is undercharged. And if you do this in a cold climate, continuously using it in cold weather, you basically just ruin the battery. So they're taking some measures now to address that and put heating systems into the battery so that if you're in a cold climate that you can still operate. Or the people like in California, some of them, maybe they go. I mean, they have some national parks where you go up a couple thousand feet and it can get very cold. So it's that you stay at a motel overnight and it's not your normal in your garage or plugged into your charger. That's the one case that the electric vehicle we have trouble with.
How about in the case of I lost my train of thought there, and I'll come back to it after we talk with Mike in Madison. Mike, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I had a question on if there's been studies on the impact electric cars will have on the grid. Because they're going to be recommended times of charge on like off-peak times or on-peak times. You know, what exactly is 1 million electric cars will have on the electricity and yeah.
That's a very good question, and the answer is not simple, of course. We would like to use renewable energy, i.e. wind and solar, and unfortunately the wind normally blows when the sun shines because you create these isotherms because of the heat hitting the earth, or that energy being converted to heat. And so traditionally you get most of your renewable energies during the day, which is the peak time that industry and everybody else is using it. So what we need is a smart system where the cars charge when the rest of the, you know, the people don't, basically the rest of society isn't using that energy. And so we actually need to come up with a smart charging grid. And if your car is 3/4 full and somebody else's is empty, they should get priority on the charging list. And so we really need to create a neural network between the cars and the electrical grid. So currently we have extra capacity at night and everybody's claiming charge at night, and you can actually get a very discounted rate in the evenings for charging your electric vehicle. And obviously with 1 million cars that are supposed to be electric, we're probably going to, you know, that demand will grow for that, those, you know, evening or nighttime charges. And I'm just, you know, foreshadowing the future here, but probably the rate's going to go up at night.
Yeah.
Because there'll be more demand. So as we, the quick answer is we have extra capacity at night. We can utilize that. I don't have the exact number of how many vehicles it will take to, you know, basically to take up that capacity. The other issue is that if we put all of these electric vehicles, say, in California, the high voltage lines going to California may not have enough capacity. And so it's kind of, if we don't spread them evenly across the United States, then we're going to be trying to transmit electricity very long distances, and that itself isn't efficient. We end up burning more coal or natural gas to send that electricity across the country.
Great, thank you.
All right, Mike, thank you very much for the call. I know the point I was thinking of is that I was listening to you with your cautions about purchasing a Leaf and storing it in my garage here in a very cold climate. Probably is chancy at best.
Yeah, so the batteries themselves don't like really cold. So by cold, probably, you know, minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit and above, you know, like, I do the math in my head here quick, like 100 degrees F. So very hot climates like Phoenix are very difficult for the manufacturers to guarantee mm-hmm. that you can operate your vehicle safely without ruining the battery life, and very cold temperatures. And like I said, below 15 degrees F, well, you know, we get there every night. So if you sit outside like we normally do and you run out in the morning at 7 a.m, you want to run, that's the worst case because it's just cold. We call it cold soak because it's been the coldest part of the day is overnight. And
yeah.
The vehicle gets the coldest and you jump in and you want to go, of course, because you're a little delayed getting in the shower and all that.
So Johnson Controls in the Milwaukee area is charged with making new batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Will they be able to make batteries that are able to be used here in Wisconsin?
Well, what's happening is we're actually adding thermal management systems onto the batteries themselves. And so if it is, we have basically an antifreeze water solution like you'd normally have in a car, something of that nature that has antioxidants in it pumped around. And then we actually have a cooling loop and a heating loop on them. And so the Volt actually takes care of this. They actually have a heater. And if the batteries actually get too cold, you basically turn a heating element on and you heat the coolant, which then in turn heats the batteries. The problem is that, here again, if you're charging overnight, you're plugged into the wall, we can just take the electricity out of your power socket. And it doesn't take a lot to keep a battery warm because we've insulated them. But if you're not plugged into the wall, we have to take the energy out of the battery itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that reduces your range. And so if we're using electricity to keep the battery warm or cool, like if you're in Phoenix, then we're reducing the range and kind of the efficiency of the electric vehicle.
Email from Mike in Whitewater. What are the chances of increasing the range of electric vehicles to allow for a 50-mile commute one way?
Well, I mean, Tesla is on the market right now. Most people can't afford the Roadster.
No. It's over 100,000.
Yeah, I thought it was closer to 200,000 if you get all the options. They're supposedly coming out with their Model S, and I did a little searching on it. They actually are offering a 160, a 230, and a 300-mile range battery pack. So it's kind of you as a consumer then can pay for the amount of commuting you would want. There again, it's, you know, it's kind of what the consumer is willing to pay for and what meets their driving style.
Tim in Burlington, let's give you a chance to get into this conversation. Good morning.
In the morning, gentlemen. I just want to bring up a point about maintenance for the all-electric cars. It should actually be much cheaper because in an all-electric car, you have no transmission, you have no catalytic converter, you have no powertrain, except for the motors directly connected to the wheels. And even in the hybrids, it should be cheaper because the engines are much smaller and they've taken some of that parts off from there.
Okay. The trouble with the hybrids is we have all the electrical components and we still have all the engine components like a normal vehicle. So we've actually added the part counts go way up. So I think you're right. The maintenance schedule for the electric vehicles will be further apart. As far as there not being a transmission, you still have a gear reduction. You just don't have a system that changes the gear ratio between the engine and the wheels several times while you accelerate. So there still is a certain number of gears that need oil. Here again, transmissions typically your service intervals like 50,000 miles, so it's not going to be that big a deal. So, I mean, overall, yes. And what's happening with these vehicles then is they're, as we do now, the onboard diagnostics sort of tell the driver that they need to take it in for service. You know, maybe something, for some reason, the battery isn't holding a charge or, you know, one of the motors doesn't seem to be operating correctly. So the feedback to the driver is that, you know, you don't have to have the mechanic tell you what's wrong with it anymore. Kind of the car does mm-hmm. that for you.
Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you, Tim.
All right, thanks.
And let's go to Paul next in Presque Isle. Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hi, and I apologize if this question was asked earlier. I joined your show a little late. I'm curious as to what the cost is from a consumer perspective to recharge an 8-hour recharge on a Leaf, and then more importantly, what cost is that in terms of greenhouse gases at a coal-fired plant versus a natural gas plant? You know, so what are we gaining in all this?
All right, now he's asking me to do math really quickly here. So you're doing I'm going to do like 10 amps on the charge here, so that's 2 kilowatt hours. So we're probably, I don't know, 10 cents a kilowatt hour. So you're looking at, you know, 20 cents an hour, $1.60 to recharge your car. For 8 hours on the Leaf. So it's fairly inexpensive. Now, you have to realize there's a subsidy built into this, and that's that the government isn't charging me road taxes. So currently, if you go get a gallon of gas, the road tax is, 35 to 40 cents.
Yeah.
If you get, you're figuring for a gallon of gas, you go 30 miles. So basically a penny a mile road tax that is a subsidy straight to you. What was the second part of his question?
What are we gaining in terms of greenhouse?
Oh, as far as greenhouse gas, if we're going to be using coal-fired or natural gas-fired, we really aren't globally saving any greenhouse gas. We're locally, you'll have less CO2 production, you'll have less tailpipe emissions. So it's a lot easier to control one smokestack that would, you know, give energy to half of Wisconsin because it's stationary and it runs pretty much steady state. So anything that runs at a constant rate is a lot easier to control than something that varies all the time, like our engines and our automobiles. And then the fact is we can invest in, you know, something to control those emissions. But as far as CO2 production, if we're using natural gas and coal, it's going to be about the same as what we would do from a fossil fuel.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Paul, thank you very much. And let's give Kathleen a call in Oak Creek, give her a chance to get in. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Hi. The question I have is, I know the Volt has the engine kind of the backup. But for a lot of people, that engine on short, you know, if you just commute, it, you might not even need that engine, but you still have to carry it around with you. The engine interface with the rest of the vehicle would be through the battery cables and some controls, of course. But you could plug that in and out, and I'm just wondering if it'd be possible to have a bolt-in engine where you can just put the engine in when you need it, like a little, you know, portable generator, or you could go to the dealer and rent one for a week if you're going on vacation. Thank you.
That's actually been tossed around, and at some of our competitions we had, it looked like the smallest trailer you can get at Menards, and we had a generator on it. So, you know, it'd be an all-electric vehicle, and then you'd have a trailer hitch in the back and put a mini trailer back.
Sure.
And that was probably about the best way that would work. Trying to bolt things in and out of the vehicle is I mean, if you've ever worked on a car, you scratch the fenders, you scratch the hood. It's just bolting things in and out all the time is probably not a great idea. The engine that's actually in the Volt is coupled through. There's one transmission, and it has two electric motors in it, and there's actually a clutch between those two electric motors. So the engine is connected to one of the motors, and then there's a bunch of gears, and then the other motor and is connected to the wheels through through a gear ratio again to get it to spin the appropriate speed. So in that case, you turn the engine on, it just generates electricity. Here again, when they activate the clutch on longer steady state driving like on the interstate, then you just power the wheels directly with the engine.
Kathleen, thank you very much for the call. And had an email from Jonathan in Mount Horeb. How far away are we from integrating solar technology into electric vehicles to charge itself?
The problem there is just the amount of energy you can capture with the sun. So if you're in the middle of the desert, you can get about 1.2 kilowatt hours of energy per square meter. So if you look at the footprint of the area of a vehicle that's not, we'll say, glass, you probably maybe have 2.5 to 3 square meters that you'd have available to put solar cells on. Now, that doesn't sound too bad because we do the multiplication. Okay, that's 3 kilowatt hours. That's pretty good, right? Unfortunately, the best solar cell right now is still less than 20% efficient. And so when you start doing that, now you're back down to, okay, I've got 3 kilowatt hours times 0.2. So, I got a half a kilowatt hour. So you have to be in direct sunlight. There are some issues with solar cells. The problem is depending on how you set them up. If one of them gets a shadow on it, you don't get any current through the whole thing. So it's like having one dead battery in a series of batteries.
Yeah.
And so there's just some issues with it. So I think it comes back to cost. It's not that we can't do it. It's just adding them adds weight to the vehicle and then the cost of the solar cells for the amount of charging you would get.
Talking with Glenn Bauer, automotive faculty advisor and senior scientist in mechanical engineering in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Let's try Mike in Linden next. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Glenn has pretty much covered about everything that I was going to mention, but I wanted to comment that I've built two electric vehicles. They both run on lead acid batteries. I currently have a 1970 Maverick sitting here with flat tires, and I do have the batteries on a trickle charge right now. But I had a heck of a time. We're in hilly country here, and going up and down the hills and getting the weight up the hill, and then trying to recover with the regenerative braking going down the hills. Became somewhat an issue, but I back in the 1980 or so, I did a Volkswagen Beetle in Buffalo, New York, and people really don't have a concept as to how much energy it takes to move a vehicle down the road. So I used to make jokes about my nuclear-powered car. They always thought it was like really green. In fact, the car was green, and that would set them back a bit. But my comment is, I finally. In recent years, I'm running all my vehicles on gasified wood chunks, and that enables me to go about. I've been all over the country. I've run, thousands and thousands of miles, and that kind of solved my problem. And and I'm just running on stuff that falls around my yard, and I cut them up into pieces and make hydrogen gas, carbon monoxide, and methane out of it.
Great, Mike. We actually, when I was in grad school, we actually had a wood chip fired jet engine in our building. So they're actually doing the same thing where they're taking the wood chips, and if you you get hydrogen and carbon monoxide off them by letting them burn but not to completion. So you drive the volatiles off of the chips and stuff, and then the carbon you have to let one. That's how you get there's carbon in the wood, so right. you have to get carbon monoxide off of it, and you can still get about 50% of the energy from carbon to carbon dioxide if the intermediate is carbon monoxide. So yes, it does work, and he's just the point there is that people want more range out of the batteries. We can add more batteries, that makes the vehicle heavier.
Yeah.
So the Volt weighs in at about over 4,000 pounds. And it's a comfortable five passenger vehicle. Unlike the Leaf is more of a subcompact.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of more of a small commuter car. So the Volt, they made it big enough that you can probably carry five people very comfortably in it.
I was looking at a story in the Wall Street Journal, and they had an estimate from a Boston consulting group that gasoline prices got to rise substantially before electric vehicles become reality.
Yeah, so if we look at this Volt, they're selling it for low 40s, so your cost is going to be, I think, 33 or 34, depending upon what options you get. Probably that same size car is probably going to be selling for 25 or 26. So you're paying an $8,000 premium then for that EREV capability.
Mm-hmm.
$8,000 is a lot of gasoline and versus the amount of electricity purchased. So the problem is it just we don't produce enough of them yet to get the cost down to a point where fiscally it makes sense for people to purchase it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we will see, and this is traditionally how it happens, the people that embrace the environment and embracing doing the right thing will pay the extra money for the Volt or for the Leaf, and they will use it. And, but for the general public that, don't make as much money, the dollar signs is their number one concern. Some people don't have enough money, it's like have a fancy car or feed your family. They're going to feed their family. And so that's where we have to get to. And unfortunately in Europe, that's the way it is. The price in Europe, they have very high taxes on their fuel. And so people conserve it because it just costs so much.
Right. They're saying in that Boston consulting group that they're looking at maybe $8 to $9 a gallon before electric vehicles would have that same quality.
Yeah, I mean, at what they're selling for today, I think what we'd see is the volume of production go up, which would bring
the cost down.
The cost of the car would probably be half of what that is, so $4,000. So. Me, I would say, if we're going to look at the break-even points, when we get to $6 or $7 per gallon, I think that's when we'll see everybody.
We had an email from Mike in Oregon. Do you know the specs for the new Smart 4.2 EV from Delmar, and what is your opinion of that vehicle?
I haven't. I was searching and Googling all the cars last night. He picked one I didn't research.
So the Smart 4.2 electric vehicle is one that we'll have to keep an eye on.
Yeah. No, I'll have to look that up. I've been in Europe quite a bit the last 2 years. So I've seen a lot of smart cars driving around. And especially in Paris, you're in there. And it's interesting that it doesn't matter which way they park them because they're as wide as they are long.
Yeah. So given the chance that you had to drive the Volt this weekend, are you intended to purchase one of them?
I actually I commute like 35 miles. So I'm the weird person that if I actually buy, I drive a Ford Focus. And
yeah.
It's a four-cylinder and a five-speed manual transmission, and it gets like 35 miles to the gallon on the highway. So, for me... I live too far to do it on all electric. I'm going to have to fuel it anyway. So for the additional cost, someday I'm going to, but right now it just doesn't fit. And just a closing thought is that it's going to take a while for us to get electric vehicles into the market.
Glenn, thank you so much. We've run out of time. We're talking about the auto industry's big gamble, battery-powered cars, and we'll have Glenn Bauer back. Thanks very much for being here. Coming up tomorrow, gifts for gardeners with Astrid and Sonia Neuenhaus.